welcome to the Free Movement Monthly podcast. We are covering September today. I'm Sonia Lenigan, and I'm joined by my co-host, Colin Yeo.
Hello.
I'm not going to give a lengthy explanation of how to access our quiz again, but I will include a direct link to it when we put the podcast up on the Free Movement website. So anyone who wants to use the podcast to evidence their continuing professional development, just keep an eye out for that. Okay, let's get started. We are starting with some policy stories, and the first one is yours, Colin.
Thank you, Sonia. So this one was about a mere £3 billion that I think I'm right in saying the Home Office had to add to its budget, basically, for asylum expenditure. And this came out of its annual report for 2022. And it turns out an extra £1.6 billion had to be allocated because of, I use quotes here, pressures within the asylum system, which I think just basically means the asylum backlog, basically. An extra £0.7 billion to implement the measures set out by the former Prime Minister on the 14th of April 2022 to fix the UK's asylum system. And then a further £0.7 billion to fund the Afghan resettlement schemes, which were also unanticipated. So the last of those, you know, fair enough. The rest of that, that's a lot of extra money that they hadn't expected to have to spend. A lot of which, as we've covered previously, they're plundering from the international aid budget, rather irritatingly, to put it mildly. So, incompetence costs money, basically, I think is the takeaway from that. And on that note, it's over to you, Sonia.
So this is, as Colin just mentioned, we have covered this issue previously, but there was a new report out in September. So we wrote again about, will the Illegal Migration Act stop the Home Office raid on international aid funds? So essentially, international aid rules allow the cost of supporting asylum seekers and refugees for their first year after arrival to be counted as international aid spending. So what that means is that some of the money allocated towards international aid actually ends up being spent here in the UK. Anyone who has spent any amount of time with the Illegal Migration Act is probably able to guess where this is going. If and when the relevant provisions are enacted that prevent people from accessing the asylum system in the UK, can they still be classed as an asylum seeker? The definition includes people who have applied for a decision and are awaiting a decision on status. And that is exactly what the Act will be trying to prevent people from doing. Also, the rules for repurposing international aid in this way do not allow for it to be spent on detention and involuntary removals. So it seems that, again, the Home Office is going to end up with some budgetary issues if these provisions are brought in, although money really doesn't seem to be much of an object for the Home Office when it comes to making people's lives more difficult. Oh, speaking of making people's lives more difficult, here's
that's an excellent, excellent intro to the next item. Yeah, before we do, I wonder if the anticipated shortfall in the Home Office budget is partly behind the fees. I mean, the fees increase. I haven't said that explicitly, but I'm sure there must be a link there. But yes, Sonia, making people's lives difficult is a special subject for Theresa May, whose book, I have to say, I have unfortunately now read, or I've read bits of it anyway. I didn't read the whole thing. This is unironically named The Abuse of Power. And it's quite an interesting project for a sort of former Prime Minister, instead of it being a memoir, basically, she looks at specific scandals and incidents which she takes the view demonstrate an abuse of power. And one of the incidents that she picks on is the Windrush scandal. And she doesn't consider it to be an abuse of her power. She doesn't consider it to be her fault, as far as I can see from the book. She blames civil servants without any reflection on who was the Home Secretary and how long she'd been Home Secretary, the longest serving Home Secretary since the 1960s, I think. She does kind of say sorry in some way. She says that she's profoundly sorry at page 209 for those who want to look it up. I can't imagine anybody will actually. Nobody's going to buy it, are they? But anyway, she says, but this is for the treatment some of the Windrush generation received in later years. And that's like a non-apology as far as I'm concerned. Similarly, she says that the hostile environment, I quote, was not a good term to use, but she's very, very keen to emphasize that others had used the term before me. And, that's kind of like schoolboy saying it wasn't me, just me, it was these other guys as well. And it's hardly very accepting of one's responsibility. So she doesn't take responsibility. And I think she doesn't really at least on the evidence of this book, I mean, maybe secretly she does, but on the evidence of this book, she doesn't really seem to understand what happened either and what caused the Windrush scandal, why it was that people didn't have papers. And she blames, again, everybody but herself. She even blames the Attlee government for not requiring what she considers to be migrants from the Caribbean and elsewhere to have special papers of some sort. She just doesn't seem to get that they were British subjects. They had exactly the same nationality law status as people who were born in the UK itself. They might have held a different passport, but that's no way to distinguish between what one sort of group of nationals and another, and it doesn't tell you anything about where they've been living for the last however long it is either. So it's a really quite depressing read. And I know some people find this kind of weird, but I've always had a sort of, I don't think respect is the right word. I always thought Theresa May was competent, and I thought she subscribed to a kind of moral code, which I disagreed with, but could understand. But this book's just really, I think, blows that out of the water, frankly. You know, it's not just about disagreeing with her politics and her policies. It's about her just not taking responsibility. And even now, years later, not understanding, the harm that she caused and why she caused that harm. So, I came out of it thinking a lot worse of her than I went in. I didn't think much about her when I went in.
Yes, my view of her hasn't changed. Okay, over to me now. And the next article is India Free Trade Agreement. Negotiators should prioritize time and cost ahead of more visas. So this article was published shortly after Rishi Sunak went to India for the G20 and after round 13 of the negotiations between India and the UK had taken place in relation to a new free trade agreement. I think round 14 may actually be taking place now. And Ian Robinson, who has experience of these matters from when he worked in policy previously, he's looked at what the negotiators could practically be asking for as part of the negotiations. And that is in the context of the number of work visas issued to Indian nationals is already very high at almost 160,000 for the year ending June 2023. So he's sort of thinking, what should they be asking for instead of more visas? And that's things like visa processing times to be improved, fees and concessions on visa requirements potentially. So that's an interesting one. And I guess it's watch this space to see what comes out of those negotiations and if an agreement's reached anytime soon. We're on to asylum now. And Colin has the first one, which is, the case on everyone's lips at the moment, which is the Rwanda case.
Yes, thanks, Sonia. I'm not quite sure how far we should go into detail in this because it kind of the article, which is by Jed Pennington, is a really excellent primer as to what was being argued in the Supreme Court. But those arguments have actually taken place at the time we're recording this. The hearing's over, and it looks like it's going to be another 2 months or so until judgment is handed down. And I'm trying to stay off X stroke Twitter, whatever it's called now. But there were some really useful threads, I thought, was it Lizzie Dearden?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Which she was sort of describing the arguments blow by blow as the case went, if you didn't manage to follow it in real time yourself. So those are a very useful resource. And essentially Jed's article goes through what the arguments were going to be, and Lizzie's thread seemed to indicate this was pretty much the sort of scheme of the hearing. So it's basically the Home Secretary's appeal against the Court of Appeal judgment. And they were arguing that the wrong legal test had been applied by the Court of Appeal when it came to sort of substantial grounds for believing that removal would expose them to a real risk of ill treatment. They were arguing that the Court of Appeal had been wrong on the evidence about the treatment in Rwanda. And also they were trying to argue that inadequate weight had been given to the British government's assessment of the Rwandan government sticking to its word, basically. So trying to rely on the similar arguments to the Shamima Begum case, where kind of judges should get their noses out of these kinds of matters where the government thinks it's important. There was also a cross appeal by some of the claimants, so sort of other arguments that had been lost or not decided in the Court of Appeal that were being resurrected before the Supreme Court. So, for example, the actual treatment in Rwanda, whether that would breach Article 3 and whether there was a real risk of that, and also whether the Secretary of State had complied with her duty of thorough investigation and examination of the adequacy of the Rwandan refugee status determination system. And there's also a point on retained EU law, which I really struggle to get excited about because it's kind of, you know, it's really, that's to do with the date at which the decisions were made, basically, and any new decisions wouldn't engage those arguments. So it's not terribly interesting sort of looking forward. So yeah, and as soon as the actual judgment's out, obviously we'll be writing it up on the day for free movement if we possibly can. And but that's not likely to be until shortly before Christmas by the looks of things.
That's what the indication the Supreme Court gave. So we shall see. Okay, the next one is me. And this is an article I wrote called LGBT People Face Persecution and Are No Less Deserving of Protection. As I'm sure you will recall, the Home Secretary made a speech with, as usual, a number of objectionable comments. This time she singled out women and LGBT people as claiming asylum based on discrimination and not persecution. Comments were also made by Chris Philp, who was previously our immigration minister and thankfully is no longer, that same day about people pretending to be LGBT in order to get asylum. I don't like engaging with that woman's harmful nonsense, but I did it anyway because I got very angry. The latest statistics show that claims based on sexual orientation are around 2% of total asylum claims. I also made a point of saying in the article that I thought the people who were being spoken about in those terms were probably all feeling very scared that day. And I spoke to someone from Rainbow Migration the next day, and they confirmed that the charity had been inundated with calls from people who were worried about being targeted and would this affect their asylum claim. So it's, you know, these comments have a very, very real impact on some extremely vulnerable people. And for that reason, they are unforgivable. So I gave a lot of examples in that article of persecution. I also looked at grant rates, which are around the same level as other asylum claims. So if anyone wants to read my little rant, that is where that is. On a sort of more neutral topic, we have age assessments, how to challenge a negative decision. And this is, I'm just flagging this up, this is a very useful how-to guide on how to challenge an age assessment. And it includes lots of references to relevant case law. If you're working on these cases, absolutely go and read that one. Still on children, I wrote a short piece on Home Office to start non-therapeutic scientific testing on children. And essentially, I wrote this one because the government has started taking the necessary legislative steps to start using x-rays on children for age assessment purposes. They have laid regulations, and those will need to be passed by a vote in both houses of parliament. So we'll see how that goes for them. I hope not so well. These procedures have been described as unethical by the Royal College of Paediatrics and Child Health. That is the use of these x-rays. Yet the Illegal Migration Act has a section not yet enforced, but which would mean refusal will be deemed as damaging to the child's credibility. So essentially blackmailing consent out of them. Now it's over to Colin.
Thanks, Sonia. And this one involves a child, but it's not really about children necessarily. So the title is First Tier Tribunal Finds That UN Agency Is Unable To Provide Protection and Assistance to a Severely Disabled Palestinian Child. Now, the sort of subject matter of this has become even more relevant since we published this with the Hamas atrocities in Israel and the retaliation that's going on as well. So this is quite a sort of hot topic, should we say. The UN agency that we've referred to in the title is the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, or UNRWA. I'm not quite sure how you say that, actually, as an acronym. And it's to do with a bit of the Refugee Convention that some people just won't know about, which is Article 1D of the Refugee Convention. And we've got a course available on this. We've written about it previously on the main blog as well. So there's a good blog post if you sort of want a primer on how it works. But essentially, if you are a Palestinian and if you can show that protection and assistance from UNRWA has ceased, then it makes you a default refugee. You don't have to meet the refugee definition of Article 1A of the Refugee Convention. So it's potentially very powerful. You can also see it as basically excluding Palestinians otherwise from the Refugee Convention, because if they can't show that UNRWA's protection assistance has ceased, then they can't claim refugee status anyway under Article 1A. But where they can, it's therefore very powerful. And there's a line of cases in New Zealand, which I don't know has been followed anywhere else so far, basically saying that UNRWA is so badly resourced now, it's not able to carry out its functions, and its protection assistance has ceased for potentially substantial numbers of Palestinians. This case, which is only a first-tier tribunal case, so it's not a sort of proper precedent of any sort, but we have uploaded a copy to Free Movement, so you can have a look through the arguments that were run here. It follows on from a line of litigation in the European Court of Justice, sort of the Court of Justice of the European Union, I should say, which often deals with, which has dealt with several Palestinian cases, and has reached a number of conclusions that have kind of, it feels like at each turn, it's been trying to follow a restrictive, exclusionary approach that stops Palestinians from getting refugee status. But in the course of doing so, has opened the door to potentially qualifying, at least in some circumstances. And this case was actually the subject of a full CJA EU decision. It was effectively remitted back to the domestic authorities in the UK to decide. They've decided it. And on the particular facts of this case, which are pretty extreme, we've got quite a severely disabled Palestinian child here, the tribunal concluded that UNRWA's protection assistance had ceased. So it's an example of, yeah, pretty unusual set of facts, but it's also one that could have wider application in future, where people are able to show that they have perhaps, you know, you start this sort of argument by showing that people with particular vulnerabilities perhaps might be entitled, and perhaps broaden it out from there. So it's an interesting decision, and it's the first I've seen for quite a long time involving Palestinians in Article 1D here in the UK. So worth your time to have a look at that blog post.
Over to me again next, and I wrote an article looking at safe routes for refugees. How does it work in Spain? Obviously, there is so much talk about safe and legal routes. It seems like we talk about it pretty much all the time. Actually, last night, John Vasiliu tweeted a very interesting suggestion, which was about an appendix conflict zone, which could be adapted for situations such as like we're seeing in Israel and Palestine at the moment. Anyway, I am interested to see what other countries are doing to try to find out if there are any examples of best practice out there. I am still looking. I heard someone mention in a meeting that Spain allowed claims to be made at embassies. I thought that sounded like a really interesting idea, so I went and looked into it further and I wrote this article. Essentially, it seems that the process exists in law, and that is as a result of Spain tying itself up into some legal knots, but in practice, it does not appear to be functioning. I'm also trying to write on the United States, as they seem to be using an app that people can access from outside the US to book appointments to make their asylum claim. But that also seems like a bit of a horror show. People are dying at the border and there is a lot of litigation going on, it seems, from both sides. So that also does not look like a great solution. But if anyone does know about that in detail and wants to write about it, then do get in touch. Otherwise, I shall persevere and try to get that out at some point. Next, I am looking at an article on Court of Appeal quashes conviction of person trafficked in the UK as a child. This is one of those periodic reminders that if you have a client who has been accepted as a victim of trafficking and they have a conviction and that conviction is related to the trafficking, then you need to look at whether that conviction can be challenged. This is something that is regularly overlooked by criminal solicitors. And then it is for us to notice and pick it up and get that conviction dealt with. So do read this article. It was on a Court of Appeal decision where the appellant had pled guilty to offences without receiving any advice from his criminal solicitors about a potential modern slavery defence. There's also a link to a how-to guide that we also have on Free Movement about what to do in that situation. And that link is towards the end of this article. The article also comments on how changes made by the Nationality and Borders Act would have prevented the appellant from obtaining the conclusive grounds decision, which then led to his successful appeal. Very interestingly, the article refers to a judicial review that is apparently due to be heard in October, very, very busy month for litigation against the Home Office. So that must be around now. And that is on the policy on public order disqualifications. Colin.
Yeah, just quickly on this one. So I was reading through this when we were prepping the podcast, and I think you'd allocated it to me, and I was like, no, it's more your thing than mine. reading through the blog post properly, one of the interesting things about this is that it wasn't accepted that he was a victim of trafficking, basically, by the Home Office. So there was this issue of, does he need to give evidence? How far was the conviction linked to his trafficking and so on? And they were saying, well, there's been subsequent convictions, so he's just a bad man that's got nothing to do with his trafficking. And the court basically says, no, we're not going to hear any evidence, thank you very much, which you kind of expect the Court of Appeal to rule. They don't like hearing evidence. And they explain that, you know, look, there is this conclusive grounds decision. It's not necessarily conclusive, confusingly, but it's only pretty persuasive. And there was also a first tier tribunal determination. So it's kind of giving guidance effectively to the CPS about how far they can really contest these kinds of cases. So it's quite interesting from that point of view. Anyway, sorry to butt in there. I think it's back
That's
over to
all right. you. Okay, so we're on to detention now. And the first one is Illegal Migration Act 2023, expanded detention powers to be brought into force. Now, it actually wasn't only detention that was brought into force with these regulations, but obviously this is another bit of the Illegal Migration Act that is now in force. Still, a lot of it is not in force. So this is Section 12. And it came into force on the 28th of September, and essentially it means that the decision on what is a reasonable period of detention will now sit with the Home Secretary. Detention can take place for examination, decision, removal, or directions to be carried out, made, or given for as long as deemed necessary by the Home Secretary. If release is deemed appropriate, a person can be detained for as long as the Home Secretary deems reasonably necessary while arrangements for release are made. To me, that definitely sounds like people are going to be waiting in detention for a lot longer while bail accommodation is arranged. I'm very interested to hear from people about the impact of these changes. So if you have started noticing things being done differently, then please do get in touch. Those regulations also brought into force provisions relating to search, seizure, and retention of electronic devices, and also consultation and reporting on safe and legal routes. But I don't find that one very exciting because I don't think much will come of it.
Yeah, the bit about detention, I have to say, I think I was being a bit dim during the passage of the bill. I feel really loath to admit this, but it hadn't really dawned on me that these detention powers were going to apply to everybody, so that it wasn't just in the circumstances where you're facing removal to Rwanda or a third country. It's all detention cases, and it's incredibly worrying that these changes have been made. So pretty depressing.
Speaking of depressing, the next article is Brookhouse: Racist, Violent, and Dangerous. So the Brookhouse inquiry has been a long time coming, and a lot of that was the battle for it to actually happen, and it has happened, and they have now reported. The report is huge, which is unsurprising given the volume of evidence that they considered. The report is a very, very difficult read. A huge amount of evidence was taken, including live evidence from some of the people who were detained as well as people who worked there. And yes, I mean, as the heading says, racist, violence, danger is what was found. Inappropriate use of force on people, inappropriate use of isolation. I mean, the way people were treated is just truly horrifying. And the thing that is one of the most concerning things is this is only a 5-month period that they were looking at, and this is only one detention center. And obviously the government has made it clear that they are not only willing and able, but keen to extend detention at pace. One part of the report, they set out, and this was also really depressing, they set out that there have been more than 1,100 recommendations that have been made on immigration detention via various reviews, investigations, monitoring bodies, and non-governmental organizations since 2003. There's also reference in the article to up-to-date evidence provided by Medical Justice, who played quite a big role in the inquiry. And that shows that these problems are not limited to Brookhouse, nor are they confined to the past. The other thing I would just say is I don't think the government has said anything about this report since it's been published.
Yeah, I was going to say that. I don't think I've seen anything from the government in response. It doesn't mean there hasn't been something. We might have sort of slipped past us, I guess. But the fact that neither of us noticed it or seen it says something about the the priority it's been given. Yeah, and you're absolutely right. And this is really depressing. And of course, immigration detention is always inherently violent, or any detention is inherently violent. You know, you're being contained against your will. And there's coercion involved in that. As far as we know, these kinds of really awful abuses aren't happening elsewhere, but they could be. You know, there isn't any evidence of that, but how would that evidence emerge? And it only emerged in this case because of the work of a single whistleblower, Callum Tully. I'm doing some reading at the moment on wartime treatment of refugees here in the UK, and just read a really depressing chapter which relays the tale of the HMT Dunera, which transported several hundred Jewish refugees, well, not just Jewish refugees, but also German prisoners of war, sort of outright Nazis, to Australia during the war. And there were some awful abuses by the soldiers who were supposed to be guarding these refugees, kind of plundering their stuff, physical violence, all kinds of abusive treatment. And, you know, there's always a risk where you're dehumanizing people, where you are detaining them, where you are treating them with a lack of respect. There's always a risk that these kind of abuses are going to happen. And the government just hasn't put in the safeguards that are necessary to prevent it. So it is depressing. And as you say, you know, with the massive expansion in detention that would be necessary for the government to follow through on its Rwanda plan, you know, that's a pretty grim prospect going forward. So not a happy subject.
What book is that you're reading?
It's a book called, there'll be a bit of a rustle while I've got it literally in front of me now. It's a book called Aliens, The Checkered History of Britain's Wartime Refugees by Paul Dowswell. And if anybody, I think there aren't that many people on Blue Sky yet, which is this kind of Twitter alternative. I haven't been tweeting out because it's not tweets anymore, is it? I've been, I don't know, posting out or whatever, clouds or something. I don't know what they're called about that. So I will turn that into a book review at some point. Probably in the near future. I owe Sonia another book review that I've been working on for about 6 months now and haven't made much progress with. So I'm planning on bringing that one out a bit sooner.
The reason I asked is because I read, I don't have it within reach, but I read The Island of Extraordinary Captives recently. And that touches, I think it mentions that that ship journey as well. I think that's the book where it's mentioned. And that is also about people who were interned. I can't remember if it's the Isle of Man or thereabouts, yeah. Somewhere near here. Anyway, very interesting. We're now completely off topic. Right. Immigration. Statement of Changes, HC1780, Restrictions on Administrative Review and Expansion of Youth Mobility Scheme. So this is just the most recent Statement of Changes. We were treated to only one in September, which was great. This one removed administrative review from the EUSS, but appeals obviously remain in place because they're required under the withdrawal agreement. The youth mobility scheme age limit was increased from 30 to 35. Prison officers were added to appendix skilled occupations. There are provisions for members of Gurkha and Hong Kong military units that have been added to the rules. Some changes to appendix English language. And there have also been several additions to the list of public funds at paragraph 6 of the rules that cannot be accessed by a person with the no recourse to public funds restriction on their grant of leave. I think that list is most significant for people who are in Scotland. Okay, the next one is me as well. Home Office redacts over 100 sections of new report on insider threat to border force. So just by way of a reminder, Border Force is the bit of the Home Office that checks people and goods at the border, as well as patrolling the coastline, gathering intelligence, and alerting the police to people of interest. This article looked at the most recent report from the Independent Chief Inspector of Borders and Immigration, which was on how Border Force manages the risk of internal threats. Essentially, issues with internal communications mean that the full picture regarding insider threat is not available to anyone, which is obviously not ideal. And that was accepted by the Home Office and Border Force. For me, the most interesting part about this report was the fact that the Home Office made 105 redactions. And the Chief Inspector did raise concerns about this and the seeming lack of oversight there is over these decisions. So let's hope we don't start seeing more of this, although I wouldn't be very surprised given how much the Home Office hates and desperately tries to avoid any form of scrutiny.
Right, one from me next. So I'm covering the increase in immigration application fees from the 4th of October. This is a miserable, miserable subject because the fees are going up by between 15 to 20% across the board, basically. Huge increases. And not only that, the immigration health surcharge is going up hugely as well by 66%, I think it is. That hasn't happened yet, but it will be happening. I think we're expecting it later in the autumn. Sonia, is it later in the autumn or is it next year that we're expecting the immigration health surcharge change?
Now, I remember CJ and I having a conversation about this, but I can't remember where we landed.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Well, let's move swiftly on in that case. there's nothing much more to say about it. It's such an awful increase. It's really punitive. It really makes it very difficult for immigrants and their families to budget and to plan ahead. It makes it very difficult for them to live in the UK. You know, there's a cost of living crisis, sort of euphemism for people being poor, basically. Now, I don't know when we moved on from talking about poverty to cost of living. You know, it effectively discriminates against immigrants and their families by disadvantaging them socially and economically and culturally. And then to really rub it in, you get people like the Home Secretary, Suella Braverman, accusing migrants of failing to integrate. And I can feel myself getting really cross about it. So it's probably just time to move on and talk about something else. I think, Sonia, you're covering the next item.
Yes. So this one is new illegal working fines will not stop channel crossings, but will bankrupt small businesses. So we made a Freedom of Information request for data on the value of fines for employing people who don't have permission to work. So it was fines actually collected versus fines issued. So there is some number crunching in the article, but essentially it's difficult to get a clear picture on what's happening with the fines. And without that sort of information, it is not possible to figure out how effective this system actually is. It's also unlikely the Home Office has any idea, but don't let that stop them. So when announcing the increase to the fines, the immigration minister managed to link this to small boat crossings, presumably with a straight face. I didn't watch him. I don't know if he did it live or what was going on, probably on BBC Parliament. The link between channel crossings and illegal working fines on employers is extremely tenuous, and that is me being generous. The minister's statement was presumably made in full knowledge of the Home Office's report from September 2020 on drivers and impact on asylum migration journeys. And that explicitly states that economic rights do not act as a pull factor for asylum seekers. A review of the relationship between right to work and number of asylum applications concluded that no study reported a long-term correlation between labour market access and destination choice. People are not coming here to work. There's no connection between these two things. So essentially, this is more nonsense from the government, but with the potential for a very serious real-world impact on small businesses. And I linked to an article by John Vassiliou, which I love because he uses the names Mr. and Mrs. Restaurant, but it's it's demonstrating a very serious situation and how people can easily fall foul of these rules.
Yeah, and one of the big problems with the fines, even at their current level, so it's normally it would be 20,000, I think it is, for a first offence. No, I've got it the wrong way around. It's 15,000 for a first offence, 20,000 for a second offence at the moment. And the plan is for it to go up to something 45,000 or 60,000 for a second offence. And one of the problems with the fees, even as they stand, is that pretty disreputable employers can just get out of it, basically, by closing, disappearing, phoenixing, the Home Office calls it, and then sort of reopening under a different name. Whereas reputable employers end up, potentially going bankrupt with the fees even at the old levels. So again, I this is dangerous because I don't know exactly when this is going to happen. You probably don't either, Sonia. This hasn't happened yet. We don't know exactly when it's coming in. I think this one might be next year, but it could happen potentially at any time. The government has announced its intent. All it needs to do is lay some regulations. So that will be happening at some point, even if it's completely pointless, even if it's arguably counterproductive and actually causes the opposite effect to that intended by the Home Office.
That's sort of the bulk of what we're going to discuss covered. I'm just going to mention some articles that we updated in September just to flag those up to people. So we updated how to apply for a UK spouse or partner visa, refugee family reunion, a user's guide, general grounds for refusal, the one covering criminal convictions, public good, character, conduct and associations. We also did immigration rules for visitors to the United Kingdom. We did what is the difference between refugee status and humanitarian protection. And I actually did the update of that one that inserted all the differentiated treatment. Luckily, I was able to dig up my track changes version from back then and essentially undo all of those now that differentiated treatment is fortunately and hopefully permanently a thing of the past. We also updated the what is the no recourse to public funds condition. And I am going to cheat because I'm going to use that as our happy ending because it already needs another update because I need to add in the latest to the long list of litigation that has been unsuccessful for the Home Office to that article. But yeah, I'm doing that thing where we cheat and we stretch good news out over 2 months because I'm writing that case up at the moment so we can cover it in detail next month.
Unless there's even better news to cover next month, perhaps. So optimistic note, uncharacteristically optimistic note, maybe we should end.
That's it for September. Thanks for joining us, everyone. Bye.
Goodbye.